This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, an important military base the U.S. uses in its fight against terrorism is under threat. The base is in the small African nation of Djibouti. If you get out a map and check it out, it's very strategically located right at the mouth of the Red Sea. There's a lot of trade that passes through this area, and that's why it's such a target by pirates and by terrorists. So we're going to talk about a threat to this base. The Djibouti government is becoming less friendly with the United States, especially because they're being courted by another suitor, and that is China. We're going to talk about what this means for the U.S. in this strategic area and how this aligns with a specific prophecy in your Bible. President Obama is waging his war on man-made climate change. He had just announced his new Environmental Protection Agency rules, putting limits on power plants and how much carbon dioxide they can produce. Now, the president is actually touting this as a money saver. He actually said, now let's be clear, there'll be critics of what we're trying to do. They'll claim that this plan will cost you money, even though this plan, the analysis shows, will ultimately save the average American nearly $85 a year on their energy bills. Robert Morley has been looking at the numbers, and he says that the idea that this is going to save you money is hogwash. We're going to talk about the devastating effects that these regulations will have on America's economy as they are put into place. The dodo bird went extinct over 300 years ago, but it still has a lesson for us today. In the 1970s, an ecologist made a discovery that taught us something about this bird's eating habits, and it actually threw some doubt on an aspect of evolutionary thinking. We're going to talk to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this interesting history, and we'll answer a question from a listener, and I'll conclude by giving you a couple of tips on becoming a deeper thinker. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The United States has only one military base in Africa. It's in a tiny country off the Horn of Africa called Djibouti, and it uses this base in its fight against terrorism. It uses it to gather intelligence on the Islamic State, on Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups. Well, China is setting up camp right next door in a new base in Djibouti, and analysts say that this could really hurt America's ability to operate from this base. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadewe, he has reported on this development, and his article is on thetrumpet.com. I have Anthony here with me in the studio. We're going to talk about this. How are you doing, Anthony?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good. So explain to us what China is doing here and why this is so concerning.
Well, this is a very crucial sea gate in the Horn of Africa. There's a lot of commercial activity going on there. It opens up the world to the Indian Ocean and to the Suez Canal and the Red Sea. It's a commercial hub. A lot of countries are interested in it. The United States is interested in that region, China, Japan, France. But China wants to build a military presence there. It's not just monitoring the commercial movement of goods in the region. They want to set up a military base in Djibouti, and this would be China's first ever military base outside of China.
They have been building in Pakistan, have they not? They've been doing other things. I know they're really working to protect that trade route that goes from China to Europe, that seaborne trade. And have been really beefing up their presence in a lot of places along that route, the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean, and then up at least through Pakistan. Is that not true?
Certainly it is true. China is definitely stepping up and protecting its interests, particularly its commercial interests, because China is becoming a strong power, the second largest economy in the world, and it's got a lot of wealth to protect.
The Chinese strategy and the amount of effort that they're putting into securing these naval interests is really quite extraordinary. There was the high-profile procurement of the Panama Canal, the Chinese company that took over the Panama Canal that is essentially a government-owned entity, just one of several places where it's putting a lot of resources and just pouring money, improving infrastructure and increasing its presence in a lot of these crucial sea gates around the world. They seem to have a very much forward-thinking mindset when it comes to recognizing the importance of these trade routes and then securing their interests there. Meanwhile, you have the United States and Britain who are relinquishing these important trade routes.
China understands that these sea gates, they are very important to keep and maintain your global power, your global dominance. This is actually what helped the United States and Britain become the dominant powers that they were. But now they are just selling those, like with the Panama Canal, they are selling them to the Chinese. And the Chinese, they are willing to invest a lot of money in it because they know how these crucial sea gates helped the United States, helped the British Empire, and they want to become a strong empire themselves.
They're taking advantage of the fact that the United States is willing to give these places up, I guess. Can you just help us to understand what is at stake for the United States? What is it that, why would Chinese presence in Djibouti jeopardize America's interests there?
Well, let me just touch on America's military interests in the region, as you mentioned. At the top, this is America's only base in Africa. They use that base to keep an eye on the Islamic State. Everyone knows the need for that. It also is keeping an eye on Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And this base in Djibouti has been the launchpad of a lot of drone operations in Yemen. So this is a very important military base for the United States. Now, if China moves in next door, a lot of people, the Pentagon, some congressmen have actually raised concerns that if China moves in, that's going to compromise the United States intelligence gathering operations there. It's going to compromise them, and they might just shut it down because China will spy on them. China will steal secrets from them. It just won't be a viable base for the United States to operate from if China moves in. And there's not a small development for China. They want to send in 10,000 troops. The United States only has 4,500 troops at their base there in Djibouti. But China wants to send in 10,000 troops. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of resources.
Just so that we understand, these bases are just right across. There's a little inlet that goes into Djibouti and the American base there, Camp Lemonnier. This other base that the Chinese are investing in, there is an American presence there. It's a smaller presence. And essentially China is swamping that American presence, and Djibouti is saying, look, we want the Americans out because we want to roll out the red carpet for the Chinese.
This is actually where it really gets very embarrassing for the United States, because yes, the United States has a base in Camp Lemonnier, but they also have a smaller presence in a city called Obak. Now, the deal that China has been negotiating with the Djibouti government requires that the United States leave that base in, or that station in, Obak. So the United States is being kicked out of Obak
So that's a done deal. Basically, in order to ink this contract with the Chinese, Djibouti said, America's got to get out.
America's got to get out. And that's essentially happening already. Americans are getting out. The Chinese are moving in. They're still finalizing the details. China is not talking a lot about the specific deal itself, but they're already working on moving in.
So why would Djibouti prioritize the Chinese over the Americans? What is it that makes China such an attractive suitor versus America?
There are a lot of reasons. Well, for one, China is certainly willing to pay a lot more money than the United States seems willing to. For example, for this particular base that China will have, they will be paying $100 million a year to the Djibouti government for it. Now, Camp Limonier, the United States is paying $63 million a year for that base. So already you see that China is willing to pay a lot more than the United States. And then there's another reason. It's pretty much tied to that. And this is a trend that you actually observe throughout Africa, China's dealings with African nations. China doesn't ask for too much in return, especially in terms of human rights, in terms of leadership, the quality of leadership. All China wants is the deals, the resources, the benefits from that. They're not asking the governments to change. They're not asking the leaders to respect human rights. So that's the advantage that China has over the United States, and it's taken advantage of it. The United States right now doesn't have a very good relationship with the Djibouti president because they believe that he's a dictator. They are waiting until his term expires. So the United States, that's all that they are placing their hope in. They're just hoping that his term expires. Maybe someone better will come in. But China is not waiting for that. China is dealing with whoever they have.
They're a little bit more comfortable with dealing with dictators.
Oh, yeah. And I bet to say they have a lot of experience with that, too.
So let me just read one quote from your article. This is from Alex Sullivan, who from the Center of the New American Security. He says, barring drastic unforeseen change in China itself, this is the new normal. There's a much larger story, and this is emblematic. What's happening in Djibouti here is emblematic of a bigger picture with China. China is becoming more active in international security affairs than at any time in the history of the People's Republic, because they have an increasing global interest. This is really a picture of the direction that China is headed, and at the same time, it's a pretty dramatic picture of the trajectory that the United States is on, as the U.S. influence and its ability to project power continues to shrink. China's grows, and we see it happening again, the same story playing out in yet one more arena here in Djibouti, this very crucial strategic area within the Middle East, off the Horn of Africa, having a lot of implications in that very vital region. Thank you, Anthony, for bringing this story to our attention. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
The name of the article, China Dominates America in Djibouti, written by Anthony Chibaderwe. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour.
President Obama says that the biggest threat to the world is man-made climate change, and he's going to do something about it. He recently announced new regulations for the Environmental Protection Agency, telling power plants how much carbon dioxide they're allowed to produce. He says these regulations are going to save money for consumers, but there are a lot of other effects that these regulations are going to have that he's not talking about. I have with me here in the studio Robert Morley, who has written an article for thetrumpet.com about some of these other ripple effects. Robert, how are you doing?
Great.
We talked about this a little bit last week. I wanted to follow up and talk about more of these effects. He says, by 2020, Is that right?
2030.
$85 a year savings for consumers. And we talked a little bit about some of the problems behind that logic. And first of all, how he arrived at that figure, just the dangers in the world that he was going to rescue us from that were caused by man-made climate change. We eliminate the flooding on the coasts. We eliminate the some of these other catastrophes that are going to happen because of man-made climate change, and we're saving suddenly quite a lot of money, right?
Yeah, he says if we can stop global warming, if we adopt these changes that he's talked about, America is going to experience a $25 to $40 billion savings by 2030. And when he starts crunching the numbers, he says that by 2030, he said ultimately the average consumer will save about $85 on their bill by making this transition.
You drew attention in your article to a statement that he made back in 2008.
Yeah, back in 2008, when he had just he was on the campaign trail and he was talking a lot about his plan to reverse global warming and new environmental regulations that he wanted to adopt. And he was talking specifically about his, if you remember, the cap and trade policy that he was pushing with regards to carbon dioxide emissions.
Let's listen to what Barack Obama said. This was 7 years ago about this subject.
The problem is, can you get the American people to say this is really important and force their representatives to do the right thing? That requires mobilizing a citizenry. That requires them understanding what is at stake. And climate change is a great example. You know, when I was asked earlier about the issue of coal, under my plan of a cap and trade system, electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket. Even, regardless of what I say about whether coal is good or bad, because I'm capping greenhouse gases, coal power plants, natural gas, you name it, whatever the plants were, whatever the industry was, they would have to retrofit their operations. That will cost money. They will pass that money on to consumers.
A rare moment of truthfulness.
Right. Well, that's what everybody's been asking. Who's telling the truth here? Is it 2015 President Obama who's saying that consumers will ultimately save $85 per month? Or is it 2008 President Obama who is telling us that to make these changes is going to cost money and it's going to lead to your electrical bill skyrocketing?
Isn't the idea that if electrical bills skyrocket, that it will force consumers to consume less energy, which is a net gain on the part of the planet, that if people are just consuming less because they just can't afford it, that's a good thing?
Oh, I think that's a large part of the reasoning that's behind this, especially if you look in the far left, a lot of President Obama supporters, the way they talk, it sure seems like they would not only welcome, they would look forward to a society where we are consuming a lot less energy. And they want that because they think that that needs to happen to save the planet from global warming.
Now, just so listeners are aware, it's clear if you just look at what's happening in the United States and you look at the amount of energy that this nation consumes and the amount of waste there is in this nation, I don't think anybody could really argue that America should continue down the path that it's going. That, let's say, if more of the world, as you see with, say, China, were consuming closer to the scale of what America consumes, then we're going to tap out of a lot of these finite resources at some point. And there really are problems down the horizon if we keep going down that path. That's pretty irrefutable.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. Coal, natural gas, oil, whatever you look at, they're called renewable resources or non-renewable resources, and they're called that because there is a finite supply. And we have populations that are growing. Projections say they'll top out around 9 billion people, which puts another 2 billion people on this planet, give or take. And there could be ramifications down the road. And I think working towards a world powered by renewables that are clean, that don't create pollution, that are inexpensive, and that are renewable, I mean, that's an awesome future to look forward to. I think that's a future that we would want to, as a people, embrace. Now, the question is, how are we going to get there? Is it by divine mandate that power companies
and
are,
by divine, you mean an administration within the United States.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. The president, in this case, saying that all utilities will reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. Carbon dioxide meaning the gas that we breathe out when we exhale, the gas that trees and plants and grass use to grow. Say we're going to reduce this by 30% from 2005 levels by 2030. And you figure out how to do it. And we'll take what consequences come. Is that the best way to do it? Or is it, you know, a market-based approach the best way to do it? And a market-based approach would be letting technologies develop themselves to the point that they're competitive on their own. They can stand alone. But clearly we're not at that point yet, or at least the president doesn't believe we're at that point because he's mandating this change, this switch over.
I would have to say that to say, well, let the market do it, probably isn't going to create the kind of change that would be necessary. I would suspect that because there are things about the market that prioritize short-term gain at the expense of long-term cost, and that companies would be in the arena of competition forced to do things or be highly incentivized to do things that might have long-term costs that they can't really cover just in order to stay afloat.
Yeah, sure. Companies are in it to make a profit. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That's how businesses operate. But I'm a strong believer that technology advances with time. And if you just look at what's happened with solar recently, they've made huge, humongous strides. And this is coming out of China, mind you, not the United States so much. But technology, solar panel manufacturing in China has driven down the price of solar where it's almost competitive. It's not competitive the way it is right now with natural gas prices and coal.
A lot closer.
But a lot closer. I mean, heaps and bounds closer to the point where some people are now looking at the future and saying, hey, this could work on its own. If technology keeps advances, we don't need these mandates. In another 10, 15 years, there'll be many parts of this country that solar power will be very viable, be competitive with the other forms of electrical generation.
So a couple of arguments that flow out of the facts that you're presenting in this article. One is, I'll just read a quote here. The bottom line is the government wouldn't be forcing the utilities to adopt wind and solar panel if it made economic sense for them to do so. Profit-focused businesses naturally try to make as much money as they can. If green power made economic sense for them, they would have done it. So this is undermining this fundamental argument that the president is trying to make that, look, this is actually going to save us money. If it were, it would happen. That's a really important point to make, that he is enforcing these by mandate in order to ensure that they happen because they definitely wouldn't happen otherwise.
That's right. They would not happen on their own because right now, economically, they're not competitive. They don't. Solar and especially wind power don't compete. Hydro in certain cases does, but most of the hydro resources in the United States have been tapped. The large-scale projects have been tapped. Geothermal hasn't been developed the way it has in other countries, and it's not applicable large-scale, it seems, with the current technologies. And because of that, utilities, they look and they say, how can we provide for our customers the most inexpensive power we can? Because otherwise, if we don't, somebody else is going to provide that service for them. And this is why the president is mandating, because currently those businesses, they make more of a profit with the traditional coal, natural gas plants.
So I think your article does a good job of exposing the deceitful nature of some of the figures that the administration is putting forward in support of this plan and saying, look, we're doing this because it's ultimately going to be economically beneficial. No, that's not true. It's actually going to be economically disastrous. And this is what I'd like to focus, the rest of our attention on is let's talk about ripple effects, because as we talked about, there is a reason why this would be a really good idea to follow and to pursue. This is a goal that's worth pursuing. It's important for us to pursue, and in the long term, it has to happen. The solution that this administration is proposing has some detrimental effects on a scale that it is not owning up to, and that could be catastrophic for the United States and the world if it were, you know, once it is followed or if it is followed.
Yes, very much so. Paul Driesen, he was writing in Real Clear Politics, and he just made the point that, and he made it so clear that electricity undermines or underpins everything we do in society. Besides oil, it's probably the most critical, maybe even more critical than oil in terms of our everyday life. And I think, well, let me just read his quote. I have it here. He said, "This will hammer everything we make, grow, ship, eat, and do." And then he went on to say, "Because of that, it's going to impact our livelihoods, our living standards, and possibly even liberties and lifespans." Because, you know, economic situations are correlated with how long people live, you know, financially, how well they're doing. And if you look at electricity, there isn't a single thing you do in life these days that doesn't depend on electricity or gasoline in this country.
How many jobs would be lost? How great would the economic impact be? They're talking about the economic benefits of the fact that, say, the Port of New Orleans wouldn't be flooded in some kind of catastrophic climate change-related event. And yet, what about shutting down dozens and dozens of coal plants?
Right. So you could take a look at Kentucky. Kentucky gets 100% of their electricity from coal plants right now. The president has said you have to have 30% reduction from not today's levels, from 2005 levels, 32% reduction. So they have to now look at their plants. How do I get 30% less carbon dioxide produced? Well, that leaves me a couple of options, doesn't it? I can either shut down coal plants and build windmills and solar panels, or we can all start rationing and just cut back how much we're consuming, and that way we'll produce less pollution. But either way, we're going to have to start closing some plants because we don't need to produce, you know, keep 100% of our coal fire power plants growing and then add another 30% on of solar or wind or whatever other option is produced. So plants are going to get shut, and it doesn't stop there. Then it's the coal that feeds the plants. So the mines get shut down. It's the railroads that transport to the utilities. It's all the little feeder businesses that manufacture parts for the trains or manufacture parts for the power plants, all the little businesses and communities that grow and depend on these. There's going to be huge impacts on places like Kentucky. Now, other places like Arizona that have an abundance of sunshine, they might do a little better because solar power makes a little more sense in those in some states versus other states. So President Obama's talking about, you know, averages. It'll save $85 per year on average. Some states will do a little better than that, you know, according to his calculations. But there's the other side of the average. We can't forget the other side of the average. And even with those sunny projections of $85 per year, the other side of that is some people are going to be doing a lot worse than that. If you want a hard number put on it, NERA, they calculated this was...
What is NERA?
NERA is the National Economic Research Association, and they did a calculation based off of President Obama's EPA proposal. So this was earlier last year before the final one came out, and they said that at that time they estimated the EPA plan would cost $366 billion to retrofit plants, close plants, build new plants to make this 30% decrease in carbon dioxide emissions. Now, that was before the final plan. The final plan was 9% more stringent than the proposed plan was. So you can add on an increased talk to that. But that's just to retrofit the plants or to build new plants. Now, if we're talking society or economy-wide, the Heritage Foundation, they came out in their conservative think tank. So they don't often agree with President Obama on his policies, but just for context, but they estimated that the total cost to society would be in the range of $2.5 trillion. And they said in loss to gross domestic product due to reduced economic activity, shutting down power plants, businesses closing up, and this transition over to this new types of electrical generation. So these aren't small numbers. $2.5 trillion is huge when you're talking about an economy that's maybe, you know, 17 or 18 trillion total in size.
I would think that the president would probably disagree with the Heritage Foundation's numbers, but listening to him talk in 2008, it doesn't sound like he is blind to the hidden costs and the ripple effects that would result from taking these kinds of actions. And he said the costs passed on to the consumers would necessarily skyrocket because of just the retrofitting. But you're talking about really it touching so many different sectors of the American economy, everything related to transportation and distribution of goods and food infrastructure and food production and everything.
Yeah, it's the middle class and poor people, once again, they get hurt the most. Rich people, they don't care their electrical bill goes up. They don't care. Well, I mean, they do, but it doesn't impact their bottom line like it does for everybody else as a percentage of their income. So your electrical bill goes up from, you know, $100 to $200 or $200 to $400. For poor people, that's big. And, you know, it doesn't stop there. That's the problem. Like Dreesen was saying, it goes far beyond that. Your food you eat at your store, transportation, all these things, refrigeration, it all runs off of electricity.
This seems like a classic example of the identification of a legitimate problem, a human mind with a great sense of its own omnipotence and omniscience and understanding the real nature of the problem and proposing a solution that will create problems that far exceed the problem that it purports to solve. That's so often where you have a human being who's probably a product of the university system and the education in the country that is very convinced of its own importance and its own abilities, say, we know how to solve this, and then they, you know, the problems that come as a result of that are just gargantuan. And they end up being far greater than what was there originally.
Right. If you like your electrical bill, you can keep your electrical bill. You know, I mean, this is what government does. We saw this with the healthcare plan, all these promises about the problems that it was going to solve. And here we are years later already now, and we're seeing it hasn't solved a lot of those problems. And a lot of the promises that were made aren't there. And that's just typical of government. And we see this all the time, and yet we don't seem to learn our lesson.
Just before we close, one last question. How close is this to becoming reality? He proposed these regulations. Are they going to happen?
They're done. They're in law. He used executive order. EPA's enforcing them. Utilities have a grace period to start implementing this. So these regulations are now being phased in. There are challenges that are coming up. Kentucky Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, he has been urging states to not comply with the federal government, to refuse to comply with it. But it looks like we're going to have a long, drawn-out battle over the legality of this.
So once that, like, is that the only hang-up, basically, the legal contention that's taking place? Otherwise, as soon as those things
Some states are already gung-ho. They're complying. A lot of the blue states, California, which is already a leader in renewables. Notably, California also has twice as high electricity costs as the average United States is. And if you want to look to Europe, they have four or five or six times as expensive electricity as we do here. Places like Germany that have a lot of renewable, their renewable is about four times what we pay here on average in the United States. But there are states that have embraced it, and they're very excited about this.
Well, thank you, Robert. The article is titled President Obama's Clean Energy Dream, or Is It More of a National Nightmare? You can read it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for coming in and telling us about this, Robert.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The dodo bird went extinct over three centuries ago, but in the 1970s, an American ecologist made an interesting discovery that opened our eyes to an aspect of the dodo's life that we didn't know much about. And actually, he taught us a lesson about the origins of this bird and a very special tree. Jeremiah Jacques has written an article called The Dodo's Posthumous Message to Mankind. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. I have Jeremiah here to share this fascinating story with us. Jeremiah, can you tell us where the story begins?
Well, it really begins on the island of Mauritius. That's where the dodo lived. And as you said, the last dodo bird breathed its last breath in 1681. So they went extinct, and I guess most people sort of thought that that was the end of the story. But then, right around 300 years later, in the mid-1970s, on the island of Mauritius, the people started to notice that one of their trees was rapidly dying off. It was the Tambalakoki tree, which is a species unique to Mauritius. And by the mid-1970s, only 13 of these trees still survived. And all of the surviving specimens were about 300 years old, which is very close to the expected lifespan for the tree. So they were all very close to the end of their lives. And once those 13 died, that would have been the end of the species. And these 13 remaining trees were producing seeds every year, but for whatever reason, the seeds would not germinate. They didn't sprout and they wouldn't take root. And so, as you mentioned, an American ecologist named Stanley Temple, he traveled to Mauritius and he just studied into this Tambalakoki tree. And he theorized that the fact that the dodo bird had gone extinct 300 years earlier and that the last new Tambalakoki trees had started to grow 300 years earlier was not a coincidence. So he said, what's the connection here? What's happening? And eventually he formed a hypothesis that was basically the seed had to be eaten by the dodo bird and then pass through its digestive tract, and then it would be able to be, you know, germinate and take root. So it was sort of a far-fetched theory, I guess. There wasn't a lot of support for it at the time, from what I can tell. But he imported some American turkeys to the island of Mauritius, and he fed the seeds from the Tambalakoki tree to these turkeys. And after they passed through the turkey's digestive tract, several of them took root, and so they were able to start to grow again. It was a pretty fascinating discovery, and right now, to this day, thanks to Stanley Temple and thanks to those turkeys that were brought to the island, the Tambalakoki tree lives on. It did not go extinct as the dodo before it had.
So pretty remarkable deductive work on the part of this ecologist. And the fact that these Tambalakoki trees still exist shows the theory was correct. So what does that tell us about this bird? Well, he liked to eat Tambalakoki seeds, but there's something about the dating that if you do the math, you can take additional lessons from it.
Yes. Well, basically, the evolutionary theory says that trees, for the most part, evolved about 360 million years ago, while birds did not evolve and come onto the scene until about 65 million years ago. And so if that's true, if that theory was true, then it would mean that the Tambalakoki tree would have had to live possibly for about 300 million years without this bird, without the dodo bird on the island there to eat the seeds and to make it viable and able to germinate. It presents some potential problems for the evolutionary theory. It says if these two species emerged at such radically different times, 300 years apart, then how did this tree, which is dependent on the bird to survive, come onto the scene 300 million years before the bird? So it's not conclusive evidence against the evolutionary theory, but it does present some potential problems for it.
That's a pretty amazing example of the interdependence of two species like this. There are several other examples that are pretty unique in creation that would suggest a certain amount of design, that it would be difficult for these things to kind of work themselves out that way.
Yes, that's right. There are several instances in nature where you have two species that are totally dependent on one another. And evolutionists do have an answer for it. They say, well, they evolved over time to be dependent on one another. But in some of those cases, it's really tough to imagine a scenario in which they just suddenly became dependent on one another. Within the framework of evolution, they do offer long-winded explanations, but it's a little bit difficult for I think most people to understand that.
It seems like a chicken and egg scenario, which came first, if one of these items existed well before the other one, how did it come to have a dependence on this thing that it was able to go on for presumably millions of years on its own without that? How did it come to have a dependency on something that came along so much later?
They say that perhaps the early version of the Tambalakoki tree did not have such a tough exterior around the seeds, or maybe there were other animals around, possibly dinosaurs that were eating it before the dodo bird came onto the scene. They find ways to explain it, to rationalize it. But really, this is a proof for God's explanation of how he created, how he orchestrated the recreation of the earth 6,000 years ago. And the account there in Genesis 1 says very plainly that vegetation, which presumably would have included the Tambalakoki tree, came onto the scene on the third day. The third day God created that, and then 2 days later, he created all the animals, including birds, which would have, of course, included the dodo bird there.
Well, I suppose the person who doesn't want to believe it, they'll have plenty of reasons why they still won't believe it. But if you do accept the biblical account, then this is just one more verification that shows God knew what he was doing all along. To me, it seems like these instances where you have that interdependence between different species is a really remarkable demonstration of there being design behind the creation.
In the 70s and the 80s, that was an argument that creationists often used. And they would say, well, how do you explain these codependent species, these interdependent species? But since then, though, the evolutionists have sort of caught up to that, and they've worked into their theory an explanation, which within the framework of that theory, it's fairly viable and plausible.
Well, appreciate you bringing this story to our attention. It's been around for a while, but you brought some fresh life to it. The article, The Dodo's Posthumous Message to Mankind, you can find it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Jeremiah, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time for Q&A. We have David V. Hill in the studio with us, our social media manager. How are you doing, David?
Doing great.
So David cultivates questions from our listeners, from our readers on thetrumpet.com, and we talk about them. So you have a question from a listener.
Yes, we have a question here. It's in regards to the article that you've talked on the Trumpet Hour about as well, from Robert Morley, why are increasing numbers of adults living with parents? And the question is from Desi. Desi asks, why is it so wrong to live with your parents? In a difficult time in life, family has to help each other. It is more economical to live together and save money or even just enjoy each other's company. Americans that are born here have a very selfish understanding of life. You throw your children out of the house and then you wonder why they throw you in a nursing home. They visit you twice a year and you think you have a family. Kids are supposed to take care of their parents till the end. This culture is wrong.
Okay. So the story that we've talked about, the fact that U.S. Census Bureau data shows that, 18 to 34-year-old adults, more and more of them are living with their parents. Even though that number has gone up by something like 3 million people over the last 5 years, the number of people in that demographic who are living on their own actually shrank by about 500,000. So more and more of them are living with their parents. And so in that interview and in that article, Robert Morley, he was talking about the fact that there's an economic part of the equation that shows, you know, supposedly we're in this great revival in the American economy, but these numbers suggest that maybe things aren't as rosy as advertised. But there's this other part of it, and that is the fact that more and more young people are just content to stay at home. They don't really feel like venturing out on their own. Life is cushy with the parents, and so why go somewhere else when you've got mom doing your laundry for you? So that's really the thing that I think we were going after. And Desi, if Desi has an issue with that, I mean, first of all, we've got to agree, family is very important. Mm-hmm. And absolutely the idea that young people should help their parents, look after their parents as their parents age, that's absolutely true. Not disputing that whatsoever. We're going after the ones that just want to play video games.
Yeah, so this isn't like necessarily a son or a daughter who needs to maybe after graduating college live with the parents for a year to get some financial stability before they go out on their own. I mean, you're talking about adults acting like children who won't go get jobs or move forward in their life.
Right. I think there is something concerning about the lack of ambition and the desire to strike out and to try to accomplish something with your life. That is concerning. That lack of fire in the belly to do something with your life, it seems like that's becoming more and more common with more young people. What something is missing. There's like an ingredient that's missing that causes them to say, hey, whatever I've got here is good enough. Why go anywhere else? You know, I was thinking about the biblical command. It's right there in Genesis 2, where God established marriage between Adam and Eve. He said that a man should leave his father and mother and should cleave unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. There's actually a command to leave mom and dad, mm-hmm, within the command to marry. And really, I think the family, like we were talking about with Robert Morley, the family aspect of it is so critical. You don't start a new family while you're under mom and dad's roof. You leave mom and dad, you leave your father and your mother, and you start a new family, and it's basically giving a man an opportunity to become the head of a new household, mm-hmm, and to embrace all of the responsibilities that would come along with that.
Leave and cleave, as the saying goes.
That's right. That's the biblical command.
So what about in a situation, say, if a young adult gets into some financial trouble, then do you think that would be an appropriate case where living with the parents would be fine?
Well, I definitely I can think of cases where that has happened, where people, for whatever reason, when there is economic duress, that is a way to provide a temporary solution. But I think the word temporary is the operative word there. That I don't think, I guess the feeling that I'm getting in more and more of these situations is that they're content to stay. I think the word content or complacent is really the characterization of what's wrong with this. If it's we have to do this because otherwise I'm going to be out on the street, that makes more sense. But even there, I think it would be a matter of, you know, how quick can we make this, especially if you're moving in with your family. The ideal is that you're able to do that on your own.
Okay, Desi, there you go. The Bible says leave and cleave.
Thank you very much, David. You can send us your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Appreciate you coming in. Look forward to the next time.
I do too.
It's time for today's last word.
What is the quality of your thinking? Are you skilled at analyzing problems? Can you concentrate on the things you want to concentrate on? How deep a thinker are you? How we think is critical. Our thoughts govern everything we do and the attitude with which we do it. Thinking is the core of our being. Superficial, unfocused thinking produces a superficial, unfocused life. Our world is full of distractions, cluttering our mind with trivialities. Our overstimulated, technology-driven, information-saturated modern life is too noisy for us to hear ourselves think. Maybe you encounter something important and you think, well, that's great. I need to do that. I need to change my thinking, change my life in that way. But then you get distracted by something else. Our world is deeply hostile to serious thought, serious life-changing thought. I realize information is not the same thing as understanding. Of course, the stupid amusement that dulls the mind, that's a distraction. But anything can be a distraction. Information, even good information, becomes another distraction if you're not thinking about it, evaluating it, analyzing it, if it's not stimulating your mind in original directions. Distractions crowd our mind with inferior thoughts. Vigorous thinking is fundamentally a matter of replacing inferior thoughts with quality thoughts. If you want to improve your thinking, you have to turn the inferior thoughts off, exercise an act of will that creates some quiet and clears space for something of substance. Thinking deeply is a matter of restricting mental associations so you repeatedly and purposefully mull a particular thing. It requires eliminating irrelevant thoughts, those musings that crowd your mind and pull you off the subject you want to be pondering. The Apostle Paul advocated such mental discipline. He spoke of bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. This requires a moment-by-moment awareness of and restraint over the images, impressions, and ideas that float through the mind and expunging anything unwelcome. That's basically what concentration is. How do you do it? Well, you may want a quick fix, but concentration is a skill acquired with practice, just like poor, petty thinking is a habit strengthened by years of practice. If you aren't used to focusing your attention, you can't suddenly summon the knack. It requires habitual, concerted deliberation. But there is a trick to learning it. Here's a simple truth about how your mind works. You naturally concentrate on what you enjoy. In a wonderful little book written in 1929 called The Art of Thinking, Ernest Dimnay wrote, "Real interest is essential for concentration and creates it in an instant. The same boy who goes a wool gathering when he has to write a literary essay can concentrate for half a day on mathematics or on a new radio implement." So concentrate on those things you enjoy, or learn to enjoy those things you must concentrate on. At least you can consciously practice concentrating on the more satisfying things and progressively work toward applying the skill elsewhere. Dimnay advocated populating your mind with greatness. He wrote, "It's impossible to spend an hour in a room with a man approaching greatness without feeling the contagiousness of distinguished thinking." He said to read about great thinkers, read the writings of great thinkers. He wrote, "Our serious hours cannot be devoted to a more useful occupation than studying the lives or ideas of great men." And he threw out this challenge. If at any moment you are unable to name a great man who is or has recently been having an influence on your conduct, you will be passing the verdict ordinary on the quality of your own thought and existence. Who do you spend your time with? Their influence on you looms larger than you'd like to believe. Scripture is filled with admonitions like Proverbs 13 and verse 20. "He that walks with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." So find those wise men and women and then really converse, meet minds, think deeply together. When you read, what do you read? What is the quality of the food you feed your mind? And just as important, when you read, how much do you think? Studying something to the point where it actually changes you requires letting it soak into the folds of your gray matter. Be honest, how much of your reading is forgotten the moment you stop? Yes, read more, but as you read, read less, think more. It's the road less traveled, but if you really want to change your life, it's the only route to take. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. The stories that we talked about on the program today are all on there. We'll even give you a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. You can contact us, send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. We're also on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. And on Facebook and Google Plus, you can find us there just by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Anthony Chibatadwe, Robert Morley, and Jeremiah Jacques. Also, thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Leonardo da Vinci. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.